like to acknowledge that we have Senator Geisel, Senator Meyer, Vice Chair Pasvan, myself, Wolakowski, and I understand that Senator Kukesh is on his way. Today we have three bills and a resolution before us. The first is Senate Bill 130, which we heard on Tuesday. This bill would establish a Native Language Preservation Council. Second is Senate Joint Resolution 10, which we heard on January 24th. This constitutional amendment would require the legislature to save during periods of excess surplus, as we have done in recent years. The third is Senate Bill 131, which would require the state to divest from any companies that do substantial business in Iranian oil and gas fields. The fourth is Senate Concurrent Resolution 17, which proclaims 2012 as the year of the Girl Scouts and celebrates the 100th anniversary of the Girl Scout, the year of the girl, and celebrates the 100th anniversary of the Girl Scouts. We'll start off with Senate Bill 130, sponsored by Senator Olson. And Tuesday we heard testimony on this bill from around the state, and the testimony stressed the risk faced by Alaska Native languages, the linkage between language and cultural identity, and the unique perspective that language gives us on how different people view and interact with the world. And I want to thank all those who testified. It was outstanding testimony, I thought. The bill would establish a council to help protect and revitalize Alaska's many native tongues. We have the bill sponsors here, and Senator Kukesh is just joining us. Senator Kukesh, we're just started on Senate Bill 130, Alaska Native Language Council.
Thank you.
And does anyone have any questions for the bill sponsors before we move into discussion? Okay, I see none. The original version received a fiscal note from the Office of the Governor for $387,900 in fiscal year 2013 and slightly less in subsequent years. We were told that version X, which we adopted on Tuesday, will have a lower note as a result of changes made in the CS. The bill does have, of course, a further referral to the Senate Finance Committee. Is there any committee discussion on the bill? Okay, seeing none, what's the will of the committee? Is there a motion to move CS for Senate Bill 130 version X from committee with forthcoming fiscal note from the Department of Commerce Committee and Economic Development and individual recommendations?
So moved. And I would, just as a comment, would commend the bill presenters. They did a fine job.
I agree. Any discussion on the motion? Okay, seeing none, the bill is moved from committee, and we'll pass around the recommendation letter document this time. Okay, thank you. We'll now move on to Senate Joint Resolution number 10. This proposed amendment would cap the amount of unrestricted oil revenue that can be spent in a given year at $6 billion adjusted for inflation, put two-thirds of the surplus in the Constitutional Budget Reserve. We heard testimony from two university experts in support of this concept. The first was Dr. Scott Goldsmith of the University of Social and Economic Research, who has written extensively about state finances. The second was Dr. Stephen Haycox, an Alaska historian and author of many books. The bill, of course, has a further referral to the Senate Finance Committee, where I'm sure it will receive a thorough vetting. It's one of many ideas on the table for trying to ensure that our financial house is in order as oil production continues to decline. If passed by the legislature, it would go to the people of Alaska for a vote. The bill has a fiscal note of $1,500 to cover the cost of providing information about the amendment on the elections booklet for the 2012 general election. Is there any committee discussion on the bill? Yes, Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, a constitutional amendment is a significant action, and it should be an action addressing an issue that's durable over time. We heard testimony that the excess funds would only exist for the next 2 to 3 years in light of declining oil production. So it seems quite dramatic and possibly inappropriate to amend our Constitution for something that will only be relevant for the next 2 to 3 years, and that's outside the additional fiscal issues of tying the hands of future legislatures.
And that's a point well taken. I would take a somewhat different perspective, which is that we're trying to put in place a framework, a durable framework, for the next 50 years or so. there's a goal the governor set. I know many, probably all of us in the legislature, I'm sure, agree that we want to see more oil in the pipeline, 1 million barrels of oil in the pipeline. If we get even close to that, we will see substantial revenues, substantial surpluses. I hope we get there. And so I think it's a good framework to put in place. And Senator Kukesh.
I want to make a comment. Years ago, I was involved in a battle in the other chamber for a state constitutional amendment. And the bottleneck was in the state legislature. And ever since then, I've vowed to myself that anytime there's a provision that will go before the voters for a vote of the people, that I've more been inclined to support it rather than oppose it. And mainly for that reason. But in this case, I appreciate the senator's comments, but I don't know what's going to happen in 3 years. I don't know anybody here other than people who make themselves to be experts and say, here's what's going to happen 3 years down the road in Alaska. And I like the idea of a constitutional amendment because I think it sets some framework for us going forward for the next 50 years. And I'm not so much concerned about the next 3 years. I have yet to find someone in Alaska who can tell me what's going to happen in 3 years. And I'm sure we'd have a hard time doing that in the lower 48 too. So my inclination is to go with what is available to us now, what the picture is now in Alaska, and make the decision based on that. But again, going back to the point is I'm more interested in this going forward because the people of Alaska will have a chance at the polls to say, here's what I think.
Thank you, Senator Kukesh. Other comments? Is there a motion to move Senate Joint Resolution 10, Version D, from committee with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations?
So moved.
Is there objection? Okay, see no objection. The bill moves from committee. Okay, next we'll take up Senate Concurrent Resolution number 17. We're slightly out of order. It's proclaims 2012 as the year of the girl and celebrates the 100th anniversary of the Girl Scouts. This bill was introduced by Senator Davis. There's a CS for it, version M. Do I have a motion to adopt the CS for discussion purposes?
So moved.
Thank you. And I'll object for discussion purposes. Here to present Senate Concurrent Resolution number 17 is Katja. Did I say it right? Katja Wasili?
Wasili,
an intern with Senator Davis. Welcome to the committee. I'm assuming this is your first presentation before the legislature. This is a pretty friendly committee, usually. If you could put yourself on the record and give us a quick presentation of the resolution.
Okay. For the record, my name is Katya Wasley, and I'm an intern for Senator Betty Davis. Founded by Juliet Gordon Lowe in Savannah, Georgia, in 1912, Girl Scouts of the USA now has approximately 2.3 million girl members and 890,000 adult members working as volunteers, for a total of approximately 3.2 million members. Also, 50 million women in the United States today are Girl Scout alumna. In Alaska, there are about 6,000 Girl Scouts and 1,500 active volunteers today. The experience of being a Girl Scout is one that produces growth on many levels. Through the Girl Scout experience, girls develop a strong sense of self, positive values such as a sense of social responsibility and citizenship, practical and healthy life skills, a drive for facing and overcoming challenges, and the ability to think critically and examine the different viewpoints of a situation. Such developments are carried over to many other aspects of life for girls and become invaluable as girls transition into adulthood and take on greater responsibilities. The difference that involvement in the Girl Scouts makes in the lives of girls is indicated by the fact that 10 out of 17, or 59% of women in the United States Senate, are former Girl Scouts. 45 of 75, or 60% of women in the United States House of Representatives, are former Girl Scouts. And 53% of all women business owners were once Girl Scouts as well. Senate Concurrent Resolution 17 recognizes the positive impact that the Girl Scouts of the United States of America has made on our society throughout the past 100 years and commemorates them by declaring 2012 to be the Year of the Girl.
Great job, gotcha. Are there questions?
Yeah.
Yes, Senator Kukesh.
Or have you ever been a Girl Scout?
No.
You had such passion. You won't hold that against her, right?
I won't. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll go to public testimony. And we have Jane Angvik on the line. Jane, are you there?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jane Angvik, and I serve as the chairman of the board of the Girl Scouts of Alaska. And I'm testifying from Anchorage, and I'm encouraging you to support SCR 17 that recognizes the contributions of 100 years of Girl Scouts and celebrates the 2012 as the year of the girl. So the staff person had indicated there are over 6,000 girl members in the state of Alaska, and they are assisted by over 1,500 adult volunteers throughout the state. Girl Scouts is one of the places where we build girls of courage, confidence, and character who then go on to make the world a better place. We strongly support and advance a program called STEM, which is Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math, where we have a program where we do Day in Women in Science throughout the state. We're just doing the Women in Science program in Bethel and Dillingham, as well as Kodiak, Anchorage, Southeast Alaska, and it provides an opportunity for girls to meet women who are engaged in science, engineering, or technology, and then a day-long program where they learn all the kinds of things that girls could become when they grow up. I encourage you to support this resolution and believe that Girl Scouts are making a difference in the lives of girls across the state, and this would be a way to honor them as well as the 100th anniversary of Girl Scouts in the United States of America. Last year, we created a program called Troop 49, such that all women in the House and the Senate in the state of Alaska are members of Troop 49, which is the Girl Scouts troop of state legislators in the state of Alaska. So join the female college in supporting Girl Scouts of Alaska and the Girl Scouts of the United States. I'd be happy to take any questions.
All right. Thank you, Jane. You've done a lot of amazing things, Jane. I had no idea you were the chair of the Girl Scouts of Alaska. Thank you for all your service.
We're going to grow the next generation of leaders.
Any questions for Jane? Okay, thanks again, Jane. We also have on the line Olivia Larson. Thank you, Olivia. Are there questions? Okay, I don't see any. Is there anyone else online wanting to testify? Hearing none, is there anyone else in the room wanting to testify? Okay, seeing none, we'll close public testimony. Any final committee questions or comments for the bill resolution sponsor? Okay, seeing none. We normally hold bills and for day, I think with resolutions, we often move them the same day. Is there any objection from the committee, or is there a motion from the committee to move Senate Concurrent Resolution 17, version M, from committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note?
So moved.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay, seeing none, the bill is moved, or the resolution is moved. Congratulations, Katja. Now go gather up your 11 votes. Okay, next up, we will move on to Senate Bill 131. Since we heard this bill on Tuesday, the governor made an announcement that he's asking the Permanent Fund Corporation, excuse me, the Armed Board and the Department of Revenue to divest their holdings from any companies doing business in Iran. I certainly applaud the governor's support for this divestment. We've done a little bit of research since that time. It's not clear to me whether here the agencies he's asked to divest currently have sufficient legal authority to do so. We talked to our legislative attorney about that, and I'm expecting he's going to call in a few minutes. We also want to learn more about that question and the fiscal note this bill received from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. One of those refers to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation custody and management fees, and the fiscal note was for $200,000 in the fiscal year 2013. And I see we have Laura here with us today. And why don't you come up and if you could put yourself on the record, and may have some questions for you on the fiscal note or the authority that you have.
Good morning. My name is Laura Ashe, and I'm here representing the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And if I could, Mr. Chair, first I'd just like to answer the question that I know Senator Kukesh is going to ask. I was a Brownie Junior and Senior Girl Scout in the Sioux City Girl Scout Council, and I appreciate the Senate's support of that resolution.
Do you have any testimony you want to give for a...
Mr. Chair, at this point, I'm here to answer questions.
Okay, great. Questions from the committee. Yes, Senator Passman.
Yeah, I don't understand how there can be a cost if you just don't invest in something. You know, it just means it's part of a normal portfolio transition. You're selling something and buying something else. So I don't understand how there can be a transactional cost different than any other buying and selling process. So if explain how there could be any fiscal note just because of this.
Through the chair, Senator Pascovan, that's a good question. There's two elements that go to the cost. One is the direct pass-through cost that we get charged for brokers buying and selling stocks on our behalf. The other cost would be the cost of having both internal and external staff manage the portfolio to these additional specifications. Now, as of now, my understanding is that we do have some of the affected stocks in our portfolio. So in order to sell those, that's going to take time to, or that's going to require brokerage fees. That's going to be a hard cost that we're going to have to pay, is those brokerage fees to sell those stocks. And that's going to be above and beyond what the board has been directing our managers to do. So that's why we represent that fiscal note. As far as the other costs, there might be increased manager fees as a result. We've had some hints from some managers that that might be the case, but we can also, on those, have room to negotiate and potentially negotiate all the way down to zero on those, so I didn't include those on the fiscal note. There also will be, on a quarterly basis, work for our internal staff, but as I look at that volume of work and speak to them, I think it fits within the existing capacity that they have, and so we didn't include a cost for that. I guess just to summarize, I understand why this question comes up. And so at the front end, you have the cost of initially divesting of the stocks, and then you have the ongoing cost of making sure you don't rebuy them. And that is a cost.
Senator Passman.
In other words, as part of the normal everyday activity of a fund of this size, there must be significant amount, not of churning, that's the word I want to avoid, but the point being of buying and selling of stocks. And so those transactional costs, whatever they may be, for example, here, if this bill were to pass and certain of those, I guess, what was it, $79 million may be subject to this, they may sell the stock and make a profit, because I assume that you believe that there's a reason you're holding it now is because, you know, there may be profit potential there. But again, if you just sell it, I just really don't see how that's anything more than a ordinary, usual cost of doing business, like having staff do the normal stuff that they must do anyway when looking at a stock and determining whether to buy or sell. And here we're just saying these are stocks that we don't want to have in a portfolio, but that's not a cost different than the everyday costs of buying and selling stock.
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, there's two different components that I'm going to which I will answer your question. The first and easiest one to address is that it doesn't seem like they'd be doing anything different. And in fact, they would. It's a very small thing, but in fact, one of the things they would be doing different is that they would have to monitor every time they would make a decision on whether or not to buy a stock. They would have to make sure that they weren't buying one of the stocks on the list. Now, that's a de minimis cost, and it's not something that we're including. I only mention it so that I want you to understand what the process is that they're going to go through. On the other point, with regard to the different things I heard you say, first we have the issue of paying the brokers, and the brokers have to be paid regardless of who directs them to sell the stock. And we do pay brokerage fees regularly. So that's a fixed cost. That's sort of like when the contractor comes to your house, you have to pay him for the lumber. You might get lucky and get his 10% discount, you know, but you're still going to have to pay for the lumber directly. The next part of it is the management part, and that's, you know, the work that our managers are doing on our behalf. And again, that's a de minimis cost that I'm not including in this. As far as monitoring, they're, like I said, some of them have suggested they might, but I don't think at this point it's too nebulous, and I don't know that that's going to be the outcome of it. So I don't even think it wasn't to me fair to put it on the fiscal note. The third part of it, you mentioned profits versus losses, and we can't really estimate what would be the profits or losses for divesting of these stocks. I will say that for the type of stocks that we're talking about, which are stocks that trade on generally on much smaller and less liquid markets than the U.S. markets or the large European or Asian markets, our managers are actually expecting that there might be some losses because we are, like I said, trying to unload a set of shares in a illiquid market over a relatively confined period of time. But again, those I didn't include on the fiscal note as well.
Yeah, just as a last comment, you know, setting it all aside, the question is whether you hold an asset or you weigh that against the blood that may be on the other side of it. And so that's where I think no matter what the cost, de minimis or otherwise, I think you get rid of the blood.
And yes, Senator Kukesh.
Just real quick, does the fiscal note change because the governor has now asked you to do something that we were going to ask through legislation?
Senator Kukesh, through the chair, I worked with our staff to get the hard costs that they could determine for doing this bill, and I don't see how that would change.
So your next step would be to tell the governor, yeah, we appreciate the letter, but here's what the cost is.
Through the chair, Mr. Kukesh, as far as that goes, you're starting to get into situations that haven't even been discussed by my executive director or my board. And I forgot to mention that Mr. Burns is very sorry that he can't be here today. He's on an airplane right now. He will be back in Juneau at midday, and at that point, he'll be seeing that letter for the first time.
And I'm just trying to figure out how you work fiscal notes as well, especially when the governor weighs in now. That's all. And you don't have to answer it now. Okay. I just want you to know that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think Senator Kukesh raises a very important point, and that is if we don't pass this bill, and the governor has requested that you sell these stocks, and you're saying in order for you to sell them, it's going to cost $200,000, which you would be getting from the legislature through the Finance Committee, assuming the bill passes. If we don't pass the bill, the governor's requested you to sell the stocks, you're still going to incur $200,000. Where are you going to get the money for that?
Chair Willikowski, we would have to find the money. And, you know, that would be a discussion that would have to happen. But again, it's at this point, our executive director and our board chair hasn't even seen the letter. So I feel like these sort of questions are very early.
Okay, but normally, let's move on. Senator Geisler had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Laura, are there other stocks that the permanent fund is prohibited from investing in?
Through the chair, Senator Geisler, no. There are no restrictions on our equity investments.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have our – yeah, I'm sorry, Senator Meyer.
I was just going to say there are certain restrictions, so like you can't do puts and calls you can't do the real high risk type trading. Isn't that correct?
Through
commodities or futures, all that stuff.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, we actually do use futures in our portfolio. We could invest in commodities if the board so chose. With regard to puts and calls, I don't know the answer to that question as to whether or not we're currently using them or whether they would be restricted. But I think that a number of years ago, the legislature turned over the investment authority to the board of the permanent fund. And so all of those things would fall under the board's purview as far as the risk versus return balance.
And I've been told that the Permanent Fund Corporation divested from Sudanese assets that were invested in the Sudanese government. Is that accurate?
Senator Milikoski, that's not accurate. The Permanent Fund has never divested of any stocks for a social reason.
And my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I know this issue came up a few years ago. There were concerns about Alaska was investing in companies that were doing business in Sudan. The Sudanese government was committing genocide on a large-scale basis. My understanding is that, well, the legislation never passed, but Governor Palin at the time sent a letter similar to Governor Parnell's asking that you divest. And are you saying that never happened?
Senator Milikoski, I do not recall a letter being sent to the permanent fund from Governor Palin. I can 100% assure you that there was no divestment of any companies, that the motive being that they were on the list. And I can assure you that there was no quiet divesting of any companies for any other motives. There was no divestment as a result of the discussions around the Sudanese divestment.
Thanks for clearing that up. Mm-hmm. That's a misconception I've heard quite a bit. We're not done.
I have a big bottle of water.
I appreciate you coming down. We do have Dan Wayne on the line, our attorney, and I'd like to just get his opinion. Dan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Thank you, Dan. If you could just put yourself on the record.
Oh, this is Dan Wayne, Legislative Counsel from the Office of Legislative Legal and Legislative Affairs Agency.
Thank you. And I know you're doing this on short notice. I appreciate it. And I know that you haven't researched this probably as well as you would have. But you and I talked briefly about the letter that the governor sent and what kind of authority the governor has to request or demand that the permanent fund divest from investments. And can you just talk briefly about what your cursory analysis shows on that?
Yes, the Constitution gives the governor power under Article 3, Section 16, to enforce compliance with any constitutional or legislative mandate. And so that might be those, the authority under which he has asked the Permanent Fund Corporation to take action, but I don't think that in this instance that it would that the Permanent Fund Corporation can act on the request under the Constitution. Article 9, Section 15 says that the Permanent Fund principle of the permanent fund shall be used only for those income-producing investments specifically designated by law as eligible for permanent fund investment. The legislature has designated by law how that money is supposed to be invested in AS 3713120. And I apologize for reading, but I'll read you this, and so hopefully people won't have to look it up if time is short. In part, 3713120A says that when adopting regulations authorized by this section or managing and investing fund assets, the prudent investor rule shall be applied by the corporation. The prudent investor rule is applied to investment activity of the fund means that the corporation shall exercise the judgment and care under the circumstances then prevailing that an institutional investor of ordinary prudence, discretion, and intelligence exercises in the designation and management of large investments entrusted to it, not in regard to speculation, but in regard to the permanent disposition of funds, considering preservation of the purchasing power of the fund over time while maximizing the expected total return from both income and the appreciation of capital. So, in putting all this together, I think what this means is the legislature has said this is the law that you'll follow in investing the money. And until we give you further instruction, then these are your marching orders. And so the bill, SB 131, adds a subsection to 37.13.120 that says, on page 5 of the bill, section 3, says the board shall comply with AS 3710.072. And, of course, that's the new section that the bill enacts that requires divestment. So without legislative direction, the Permanent Fund Corporation can't divest from the RAND investments unless it would satisfy the requirements of the prudent investment rule. And it doesn't seem like it would, as the rule has been sort of described under 3713.120.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. And I know you did this very quickly, and I appreciate, the committee appreciates your quick review of that. Questions from the committee? Okay. I don't see any. Thanks again, Dan.
You're welcome.
I think we're gonna go back to Laura for some further questions on the fiscal note. And thanks for holding on. So my understanding is that when you generated the fiscal note, you went to your fund managers and asked them if you thought there would be a fiscal note. Is that how it occurred?
Yes, that's how it occurred.
So how many fund managers are there?
Off the top of my head, of active fund managers in the neighborhood of, say, 20 to maybe 25. Maybe we're around 20.
Okay. And I'm not going to hold you to
that. No, I understand.
Number, but of the 20 or 25 mm-hmm. that you went to, how many came back and said there would be a cost?
I had three of them that came back and said a cost. For most of them, they simply don't operate in the regions that this bill would affect. And so they looked at it and just said it's not really going to affect us. We're, you know, not anticipating a cost. It doesn't mean that a few shares couldn't pop up in their holdings, but it wouldn't be enough to quantify. I had three managers that came back that all operate in the international or emerging market space. And as I briefly alluded to before, two of them gave us lump sums that also seemed to incorporate their expected investment losses. I think the reason for that is they're usually used to operating. Some of them also operate commingled funds, and if you try to pull out of a commingled fund, they do charge you the losses. But for us, they wouldn't because these are separate accounts. So those I didn't include on the fiscal note. I do believe that in those bulk estimates, they did include some transaction costs, but I wasn't able to tease out what those were. And so I didn't include that. But so I had those. And then I had the one that I don't know if I called them out by name in the fiscal note or not, but I did have one manager that both gave us an estimate for manager fees, which again I didn't include in the fiscal note because that's going to be negotiable, and then they did say that there would be transaction costs. And I mean, the $200,000, please understand, it's not a definitive statement, it's a rough estimate based on how they thought based on the number of shares they thought they might have to divest from.
And so, just so I'm clear, so of the 20 or 25 that you asked if there would be a cost, ultimately, you're basing the fiscal note on what one of those is saying, the $200,000. And do you have the bill in front of you?
I do.
If I could get you to turn to page 2 in the bill, lines 5 through 11.
Yes.
I'm sure you're aware of that. There's a provision, and we put a provision in here that says if an investment in the fund is managed as a commingled investment or other business structure in which the fund is not the sole owner, the provisions, basically this law doesn't apply. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you can explain to us, is this a commingled, it sounded like you were talking about this being a commingled investment.
Senator Wilkowski, I'm sorry to have muddied the waters by even saying the word commingled. The only reason I alluded to it is because I think with two of our managers, they were using their cost estimates based on their only experience with this sort of thing, which is when they have people trying to pull out of commingled funds or direct them on commingled funds. And we didn't accept that because we're not a commingled fund. And so we thought that their estimates upon our reflection were not appropriate for the fiscal note. All of the managers that we're referring to today, the ones that didn't imagine that there would be a cost and the ones that did, are separate account active managers. So they do not fall under either of the exclusions that are in the bill.
Okay, so you're saying that this one fund manager, my understanding, it manages about $1.3 billion?
All total, it's 1.4. Of two of the smaller accounts are commingled funds, but the primary account to which these costs would apply is a single fund of $1 billion. It's international large capitalized company stocks.
And my understanding also is that we pay them about this one particular fund manager about $350,000 per quarter. Is that accurate? This one particular fund manager management fees of about $350,000 per quarter.
Senator Wilkowski, I don't know where that number comes from. It sounds actually kind of small to me for what manager fees would be.
You know what the number is?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. Manager fees for our managers vary anywhere from, 20 to 60 basis points. This is a rough guess, and a basis point being a fraction of a percent. So, I don't have the number right at my fingertips.
Okay. And so have you had your lawyers look at it, or have you looked at this section B on page 2 to see whether or not that provision would apply? And have you had any analysis done?
This provision, I did speak with our attorney yesterday, and this would not apply to the $1 billion fund because it's a separate account. So.
Even though the stocks are, and because this says if an investment in a fund under A of this section is managed as a commingled investment, so I guess it comes down to what the definition of a commingled investment. But
I'd be happy to.
It seems to me like it's a commingled investment, but
the definitions. I'll go through all three of them. An active account is an active separate account is an account where the account manager, and please keep in mind that when I say manager, I don't mean a guy in a bow tie. I mean a firm of anywhere from, I've seen some very small ones that maybe have 30 or 40 people, up to thousands of people located all around the world. And so we have active separate account managers who are making buy and sell decisions based on what they think is best for our individual portfolio. And then we have passive managers who are aligning the portfolio directly to an index and charging us a significantly smaller fee to do so than compared to our active managers. We include both of them in our portfolio to gain the risk advantages of passive mandates against the return advantages of active mandates. Then we have commingled funds, and in a commingled fund, we are blended with other institutional investors. And so they're managing, it's like a mutual fund, except that, funds can buy in, not people. And so in that instance, much like an index fund, the strategy is set, whether it's set because it's matched to an index or whether it's set because people are buying a product. And so we don't have the opportunity to change it. And so that would be what would differentiate those two types of funds from an active manager.
Thank you. Senator Bassman.
Sure. And you use the terminology basis points, and just follow exactly what you're saying, because my calculation is that as a rough basis, the transactional cost would be about 25 basis points at most, and then you're saying that it may be negotiated lower than that, and assuming that's the case, then the state of Alaska gets 99.75% of the value of the asset subject to maybe you getting a little bit more of it through your negotiation?
Through the chair, Senator Pasvan, a basis point is if both it is a fraction of a percent, so it's essentially a ratio. And so the $200,000 figure I quoted you is 2 basis points of the billion-dollar portfolio. So, and I'm sorry, there was a second part to your question that I'm not, that I...
So if it's 2 basis points, then if you were to apply that, is that 99.8%? That's the value that's left after you take out the 2 basis points?
Through the chair, Senator Pasvan, one could look at it that way, but we don't approach it that way. I guess I don't understand exactly what I understand the basis of your question. I'm not sure where you're asking me to go with that.
You start out with assume that it's a $100 investment. You have a 2 basis point transactional cost. What's in your pocket after you pay the basis points?
It would be the remainder if we were to sell that stock at full value. But keep in mind that those basis points.
Again, please answer, sure. If I may, Mr. Chair. Please answer the question as far as how much of the $100, what is that figure?
If you subtract, now I'm having to do math in my head.
Isn't it $99.80?
Through the chair, Senator Pasquin, you were correct. And I have not had my coffee yet. So.
I just want to make sure that there's a comprehension of the perspective here so that one can get distorted when you think of $200,000. But when you look at it as compared to the value of the asset, if you nominalize it to $100, you say it's the 2 basis points that you're addressing. We sell it. We have $99.80 of that $100 transactional cost.
Yes.
That's what I want to make sure it's understood.
Yes.
Is there a section in the contract that you have with the fund manager, this particular fund manager, that has that discusses coming to an agreement as to how much should be charged in the event of unforeseen circumstances, like a legislative change?
Senator Wilkowski, I'm not intimately familiar with the contract section by section, so I can't answer that directly.
I don't personally have any further questions on the funding issue. That would be an issue. I mean, the Finance Committee would delve into that. I do have a question, though. You heard the testimony of Dan Wayne, and I guess my intuitive reaction when I saw the letter was the governor can't call up the permanent fund or send you a letter and say, I want you to invest here, I don't want you to invest there. But maybe I'm wrong. What's your take?
Senator Wilkowski, on those sorts of questions, I have to defer them back to the law department. They are the ones that interpret statutes on our behalf.
Do you know if governors regularly call you up and ask you to invest in certain companies or not invest in certain places?
I don't believe it regularly happens, no.
That's a good thing from my perspective. Other questions from the committee? And I'll just say that. Yeah, Senator Kukesh.
Kind of off-the-wall question, but when you get your answer from your legal department, could we hear what the answer is on whether or not you have to listen to the governor and his letter?
Senator Kukesh, through the chair.
I mean, no, it's fine.
I'm only hesitating because I don't know the answer to that. I feel like that would be a question that would have to be answered by our executive director and our attorney. So.
Thanks.
Thank you.
If we could hear the Mr. Chair, yes. We could hear the answer to that. You know, again, whatever it may be, because I would like to know the substantive basis as to why the answer could possibly be no.
And I just want to follow up on that. If this is new ground, and we don't know how the answer is going to be, so we want to follow the process, and I do in my head, because you know what happens again in the future, I want to know how it's supposed to work. That's all.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any other questions? And I just want to say thank you because you have been very responsive. I appreciate what you've personally done and the Permanent Fund Corporation has in working with my office and answering our many questions that we've had since we filed this bill. So thank you. I'll leave it to the committee's discretion. We can hold the bill for another hearing, or we can move it today. Do we want to try to wait and see what if we get a response back from the permanent fund?
Do they have? Does the permanent fund have an idea as to when we should timely receive a response?
Do you think you could get us something by next Tuesday? From your if you have, I guess what I'm sensing from the committee is they would like to hear what your opinion is of the governor's letter. In other words, do you disagree with what our legislative attorney said, Dan Wayne, that this is a nice letter, but it doesn't give you the authority to actually divest, number one, and number two, can the governor order or require that you divest? Do you think you could get us some sort of response back by the next committee hearing, maybe Tuesday?
Senator Wilkowski, and please know that I'm trying to answer the best of my ability. I would hope that we would have an answer as soon as possible to that question, but it's all going to be on the – believe me, I would love to have an answer to that question as soon as possible, but it's all on the shoulders of the Department of Law. So I'm not going to make any promises on their behalf.
Okay. Well, we'll hold the bill until Tuesday then and see – and if you could, we – I think the committee would appreciate that information. And Senator Meyer?
If I may, I think we've had some good discussion here because I do recall the previous governor basically saying the same thing, and maybe she just did it verbally and not in writing. And I don't know if verbal versus writing carries, one carries more weight than the other. But I do think Governor Palin had said, let's not invest in Sudan. So it would be good to get that answered, when the governor intervenes, what you guys can and can't do. But on the other hand, too, and it's certainly up to you, Mr. Chairman, I mean, I think from a policy standpoint, I think this bill is right on. And, from that standpoint, I'm comfortable with moving the bill. But if you want these questions answered first before you release the bill, that I'm perfectly fine with that as well.
Senator Kukesh?
I don't think this would change my position on moving this bill, whether or not the answer comes back yes or no. I think we ought to move this bill. It's a policy question that the legislature needs to answer, and let's just move it and try to get it through the process. We don't have much time.
Yeah, fair point.
Mr. Chair, given the discussion, I move that we move Senate Bill 131, version /M, from this committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note.
And can I just maybe offer a friendly suggestion? From the attached fiscal notes from Department of Revenue and the Permanent Fund Corporation concerning their operations and a revised fiscal, and I just for the record, a revised fiscal note concerning Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation custody and management fees may be forthcoming. Okay, is there discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Scheer. In spite of this letter from the governor supporting this and certainly some really valid points made about Iran, I'm still in a dilemma about this bill because it politicizes investing. And, we've spent a lot of time bestowing accolades on Norway and how they manage their fiscal matters with a very impartial, objective financial group. And the same can be said of our permanent fund board, objective, impartial. This action creates a political aspect to this. And I'm concerned about the Me Too cascade that could begin. I'm holding a pencil right here that's on our desk that says Vietnam on it. Well, perhaps I have objection to us purchasing products that are produced in Vietnam. It creates a cascade, and it creates a dilemma for me. I certainly don't dispute the terrible things that Iran is and potentially could be doing in the future, but I wanted to have on the record the fact that this does start a cascade. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And that's the argument opposed to doing this, and that's why that argument has prevailed for the last since we've had the Permanent Fund Corporation. I think it's a case-by-case basis, and you look at each individual case. And I would just note Norway does have actually complete social investing. They they have a board that does not allow investment in tobacco companies. I mean, that's a full-blown social investing situation that they have. In this particular case, I'll let you respond in a second. I think this is a unique situation. I think with the country of Iran, you do have a country that is a known sponsor of state terrorism. You do have a country that we know is developing nuclear weapons, which would destabilize the region. We have evidence that they are using their oil funds to give to terrorist groups to target American soldiers. So I think this is a unique situation. I think it is different. And I think as a policy, we shouldn't be supporting those things. But I certainly respect the disagreement that you have. Did you want to respond?
Well, you brought up Norway. I have an article here. Their ethics board recommended they divest from PetroChina, and their investment board declined to do that. So I think they're still kind of independent.
Yeah, interesting.
It's a difficult topic.
There's a motion. It's good discussion. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, seeing none, the bill will move. And if you could just hold on and sign the sheet very quickly, and with that, we're adjourned.